Arabic is the official language of more than 27 countries, and there are more than 400 million speakers of the language worldwide. Yet in the US, for example, less than 1% of students study Arabic. Studies have shown that those who speak a second language not only earn more, but are in higher level positions than their monolingual counterparts. And there's no shortage of studies that point to the benefits of students at the K-12 level learning a new language. The National Research Council in 2007 found that children who study a foreign language show greater cognitive development in areas such as mental flexibility, creativity, and higher order thinking skills. Qatar Foundation International inspires meaningful connections to the Arab world by creating a global community of diverse learners and educators, connecting them through effective and collaborative learning environments inside and outside the classroom. Qatar Foundation International builds bridges across cultures by increasing the number of K-12 students in the Americas and the United Kingdom with a good knowledge and understanding of Arabic language and culture, by increasing the number and quality of Arabic programs in state and public charter schools in the United States and other countries. Qatar Foundation International supports the teaching of the Arabic language through grant giving and programming activities, while increasing and professionalizing the supply of highly qualified teachers of Arabic, thus raising the visibility of a growing profession through grants, professional development, and free online resources. For more information on free teaching materials and available grants, please go to qfi.org and ispeakarabic.com. This episode is brought to you by the Mikkelsen 20mm Foundation, a non-profit based in Los Angeles, California, that supports and invests in leading-edge entrepreneurs, technologies, and initiatives with the potential to improve access, affordability, and student success in higher education. In 2016, 20mm launched the Mikkelsen Runway, the world's first accelerator dedicated to supporting innovations in higher ed and career training. Both were founded thanks to the generous support of renowned spinal surgeon Dr. Gary K. Mikkelsen and his wife Isla. Visit 20mm.org and mikkelsenrunway.com for more information. And now, a quick message from our friends at Class Central. It's been more than half a decade since free online courses from Stanford kicked off the modern MOOC or Massive Online Open Courses movement. Since then, more than 700 universities around the world have launched MOOCs, and more than 60 million people have taken at least one course. Class Central has been keeping track of the MOOC space right from the beginning. Over 10 million learners have used Class Central to find and review online courses. As the number one search engine for online courses, Class Central provides a comprehensive listing of more than 8,000 MOOCs. Class Central's MOOC Report blog contains the most comprehensive coverage of the industry, including a recent listing of the top 50 MOOCs of all time. To find out what's up, down, new, or just slightly left field in the world of online courses, head to www.class-central.com/report. Hello and welcome everyone to this final edition of the ASU GSB Summit series on the EdTech podcast. My name is Sophie Bailey and this series has been dedicated to bringing together the whole spectrum of learning and talent innovation from around the world. If you came to our London meetup this week, hello again. So, what's happening this week? Well, this week I'm in conversation with the wonderful Sandy Spiker, Managing Director at IDEO Education Practice. We talk about the very pressing issue of design thinking in education, something we touched upon previously in episode 80. Sandy works with organisations across the public, private and social sectors, constantly exploring ways to design more effective and inspiring systems. She and her teams have helped to create a scalable, affordable school model in Peru, strategies to improve schools for the poor in India, digital learning platforms that meet the needs of today's students, and a new vision for the food system in San Francisco schools. We also dip into the parallel universe of Mona Lisa Kitsch. As this is the last episode in the ASU GSV Summit series, I'd like to give a big shout out to everyone at ASU GSV Summit, including Deborah Quazzo, Michael Moe, and the whole rest of the team for making the series happen. A big thank you also to our wonderful and sporting guests who joined us from as far afield as China, France, the US, and Australia. If you'd like to delve into more content on the theme of design thinking, check out this week's extra features via our weekly email, asugsvsummit.com, or via @podcastedtech. You can also listen in at the end of this week's interview to hear from Nick Robinson, co-founder and CEO at ELT Jam, on what learner experience design means to him and why ELT Jam are launching Innovate EdTech, focusing on design thinking in EdTech on November the 11th. Whew! So, the ASU GSV Summit series has finished. What's coming next? Well, first up, we've got three recordings from the Future of EdTech event earlier this year. These recordings have a focus on higher education innovation and feature Olivier Crouzet, Director of Pedagogy at Ecole 42, Heidi Fraser-Kraus, Director of Information Services at the University of York, and Nicole Engelbert, Director of Research and Analysis at Ovum Technology. So keep your eyes and ears peeled for all of those. In other news, I've been squirreling away and working very hard on a brand new series, which launches on November the 5th, Fireworks Night, hopefully with a big bang. The series, produced in partnership with Pearson, is titled Future Tech for Education and explores the implications of and questions around future tech for education. I speak to a whole range of people from across industry, research and academia about everything from AI, digital citizenship, language technology, AR and VR, gaming, assessment without tests and what really is personalised learning. Look out for our trailer on the series out soon. So, there you have it. A big shout out to the ASU GSV Summit, Qatar Foundation International, the Mikkelsen 20mm Foundation and Class Central for sponsoring this week's episode. And don't forget, if you enjoyed the series, you can drop us a review on iTunes where you can also rate the show. So without further ado, here's episode 89 with Sandy Spiker, Managing Director at IDEO Education Practice on Design Thinking in Education. I'm really delighted to be here with Sandy Spiker.
Oh, that's right.
Good
Wonderful.
Job. Managing Director for IDEO's Education Practice. And I've put here, and a great enthusiast for Mona Lisa Kitsch.
That's true.
So can you tell us a little bit about that, first of all?
About the Mona Lisa Kitsch?
Yeah, why not?
Well, I do collect Mona Lisa Kitsch. And what I love about it is she's the greatest work of art of all time, from many people's understanding. But I also have like a rubber duck that looks like Mona Lisa, and her like bill is sort of smiling. And I love that it's just so ironic, and it can be both high art and kind of...
And playful as well.
And playful at the same time.
Have you yet taken, like, I guess you guys would call it a chip? You know, in the UK, we have like really trashy newspapers, and someone will put a piece of bread in the toaster and pop it out and say that there's the picture of Jesus Christ on it. So I didn't know if you'd had that experience.
I don't have Mona Lisa toast yet, but that is, I would love to.
That's an aspiration. Yeah. Okay, amazing. So I've just read your bio, and it's frankly very interesting. So can you tell us a little bit about, you know, your education practice at IDEO and how you got into that, and
sure,
how it fits into, I suppose, what's a quite interesting design perspective on the world as well?
Sure. Maybe it would be good to just explain what IDEO is. IDEO is a organization. We work around the world, and our kind of role in the world is to help other organizations innovate. We like to use design to make the world better. And that happens across all different types of sectors, healthcare, retail, but I have focused over the last decade around our work in education.
And how did you come to be in that role? Did you kind of grow up through the organization? Did you come straight in? Or?
Yeah. Well, my background is in design. I studied visual communications, but I also always taught. And I taught 10-year-olds design for many years, and I taught at a university. And I studied education in addition to design. When I started at IDEO, I was working in our organizational change group, where we were applying principles and practices of design to different organizations. How can they design themselves better?
Yeah.
And I realized that that's what we really needed in education. And IDEO is a very creative environment, and nothing really happens by strategy. It happens kind of by emergence. And so I felt pretty passionate about the idea of taking this process that we do all the time, where we design for people's needs and come up with creative solutions. And I said, I think we need to do this in education.
So that's really interesting, because I met, and I don't know if you follow him on Twitter, his moniker is at Tech Rabbi. His background, so I can't remember if he was a computing teacher, but he also studied design and is very passionate about design. So he's constantly like drawing these amazing things, putting them out there. And I mean, I think his perspective, and I wondered what yours would be as well, is how can schools and people within schools use design to perhaps get some of those new ideas across?
Yeah.
So is there a remit for doing that better? And I say that in the context of, you know, in some schools we still have the sugar paper on the wall, and just wondered how might someone listening in apply what you do within the context of their own institution?
Yeah, it's a great question, and you've put a lot of questions into one, actually. And so if you don't mind, I just kind of want to go line by line.
Yep.
The first thing is, I think, to understand what your own narrative about design is for each of us. A lot of times people have heard about design for fashion. They think about it with clothing, or they think about it with architecture or interior design. People have a different entry point of understanding design.
Yep.
The way that we tend to think at IDEO, which a lot of people in the world also orient around now, is a term called design thinking. So what that is about recognizing that designers, whether they're designing clothes or interiors or buildings, have a certain way that they look at the world. They ask questions that might be different than other people because they're looking to find new answers. And a lot of people over the last, I think, probably 15 or 20 years have said, how, if we realize that actually everything is designed, not just clothes and not just your interiors, but everything is designed, our schools, our hospitals, our politics, everything has been designed, maybe unintentionally, but it has been designed by somebody. How might we learn from the way designers think and act in order to better design those systems? And so, if you think about a school, there are so many things that are designed in a school. Yes, definitely the building. Yes, the curriculum. But also the interactions between teachers and students. In fact, the role of the teacher has been designed. In fact, the educational standards have been designed. There are so many elements of schools that have been designed. And once we recognize that, we can actually start to design them better or more intentionally.
And given that there's so many aspects that have been designed, do you have a kind of best practice about how to go about, you know, redesigning some of those so that it's not completely overwhelming?
Yeah.
Because you don't want everything to unravel at once.
That's right.
Yeah.
Absolutely. With something as complex as a system like education, everything hinges on each other. So you're absolutely right. If you try to change one thing, it changes a lot of things. But I will say that there's not like a definite entry point that's the best beginning. But I will say there's an attitude that's really wonderful to begin with, which is to try to understand other people's experiences. A lot of the times we've been a customer of something. We've used a phone, we've been through a hospital, we've been to school. And so we think we know what the experience should be or could be based on our own experience.
So that's very true in the UK at the moment, where we have quite a live grammar school debate. And a lot of the people that perhaps are pushing grammar schools may have benefited from them themselves.
Right.
Whereas there are also lots of people that perhaps weren't able to progress in the education system of grammar schools who had a very negative perception of that as well. So
especially when you're designing in education, but I would say it's true of everything, empathy is one of the most important things. A lot of times people will either design for themselves or they'll design for their assumptions. Oh, I know my customer, I know my patient, I know my student, without really keeping an open mind to how things might have changed and how people might have changed and what they care about now. And to be a great designer, I think in schools, you have to constantly be asking the question, who are people today? And what do they care about? What motivates them? What engages them? And then the tricky thing there is that schools are not a consumer product. You don't just design for their interest. You actually have a set of ideals that a country or a system or parents actually have for children. And so there's an art to then marrying those two agendas.
So that's very interesting, because I know that you've had quite a lot of international experience and, you know, applying some of your design thinking to different geographical contexts. So can you kind of perhaps share some of those varied experiences and how that played out?
Yeah, maybe I can give an example of some work we've been doing for many years, partnering with Innova Schools in Peru. Innova Schools is an affordable private system, and they came to us pretty early on and basically said, we'd like to design a system of schools that would be affordable for the emerging middle class, have an international quality, and could scale to disrupt our country's education system. Because Peru, despite its constantly growing economy, had been scoring quite low on global surveys of education systems. In fact, they were number 64, 65 in the last round of this PISA survey, which ranks countries' education systems. So they recognized there's all this economic growth, but their schools were not keeping pace with the growth of society, which meant there's going to be a big gap between what the opportunities that people will have.
Yep.
And so we were asked to design a system of schools, which, you know, I don't know about you, but I'd never done before, to be honest, when they
I can't say I've done that either.
Yeah. I mean, imagine just like getting a phone call of somebody saying, hey, we want to disrupt our country's education system. Can you design that? IDEO happens to be a place where our response to that is, well, of course we can. We have a process for design. So we don't know the outcome. I don't know what the right answer is, but I know that we can go on a journey to get there. And that journey starts with talking to a whole lot of students, a whole lot of teachers, a whole lot of parents, to understand all the different needs and desires that people have. And I'll say just because a school is such a complex thing to lay out, they now have, and this was 4 or 5 years ago, they now have 41 schools and they're growing year over year. They've got 36,000 kids, I think, that they're working with. They're seeing results that are double or triple performance from the government schools, depending on what subject area you're studying.
Yeah.
And so I kind of gave you the end there because now I'm going to tell you that we learned a lot about teachers and students and parents and about what their needs were, about what they were struggling with, and also that they wanted a better future. And so we had to really think about how do we design schools that would be right for where they are and help them grow into the future.
And on that note, were you able to design around, I mean, obviously affordable schools, you mentioned it's for the middle classes. What happens to those people that don't quite tip into that bracket as well?
Yeah, so this Innova Schools decided that they would serve the emerging middle class because it was kind of one of the most rapidly growing parts of society, but they didn't have a lot of options. Already, those parents were sending their kids to private schools that were not quality. And so Innova was looking to create a quality solution for those parents. But the tuition, super low, like $100 a month was the target of the price point. And so that's the intervention that they decided to create.
And what was your own education experience like? So going back to sort of people's personal reflections on, you know, the education experience and perhaps how that might play into how you think about design as well, even though we try and separate the two.
You know, I went to public school in my town. I don't know, different countries say different things, but government schools. What do you guys call public schools in the UK?
So it's really stupid. We call public schools state schools.
Okay.
And then we call private schools public schools.
Oh, very confusing. That is very confusing. Anyway, I went to my town's school. Yeah. So I went to the state school equivalent in my town, and I was really liked school. And so I'm not sure if there's anything in my education that really stands out.
And what was home for you? Like, where did you grow up?
I grew up in New York.
Okay, yeah. So one thing I always ask everyone is if there are particular people, books or resources that you like to go back to that kind of inform your own practice, and that might be on the design side of things, or it might be something completely different, but something that you found inspiration in that you might like to share with other people.
I love that. That's such a great question. My first thought is the people that we're designing for is constant inspiration. When I mentioned the work that we did in Peru, I didn't really tell you stories, but the kids there and the families there gave me so much inspiration. And kids showed us their notebooks that in the state schools there, what they've got is adults just kind of speaking to them and they're transcribing thoughts into notebooks. And I had kids show me their notebooks and kind of talk about how they craved for their imagination to be engaged. They loved when they got to draw something or when they were able to doodle in the corner of their notebooks. I think about those stories a lot. And actually, a lot of what we designed in Innova and Innova's school model was making sure we kind of defended the right for a kid to have their imagination engaged. And so I find for me that being in kind of pulse with people that I'm designing for, or no matter what I'm working on,
yeah,
helps me be really inspired.
And so that's usually is it a sort of formal research group, or is it just, you know, a continual process of going into these schools? Or
I think there's a continual process, definitely. But sometimes just one-on-one interviews.
Yeah.
I don't love group ones as much because I like to get in there and kind of have people show me what really inspires them.
It's quite differently. Yeah.
So it's so meta. Your question was, what inspires you?
And I
was
like, self-reflexive,
people.
You know?
Yeah, that inspire me. Yeah.
What's your biggest priority and challenge right now?
I feel really lucky. I get to work with the people that I do, both my team and in the world. But it is a very difficult sector.
I hear this again and again.
Yeah.
It's not a sort of straightforward, you know, line between these players. It's very jumbled.
It's a network. And really, it's about balancing at the intersection all of the needs of so many different people and all of their hopes and dreams, and putting that into a context where actually they can fulfill on it. And so one of my areas of focus lately has been, actually over the last 8 years, but even more so lately, has been, how do we support teachers to recognize that they are designers? Teachers are designing all the time. They're designing curriculum, they're designing spaces, they're designing interactions with students. They don't often think of it that way. In fact, the system doesn't really regard them that way. But when they realize that, they can be magical, because they can then find their inner creative force, the thing that drove them to teaching in the first place, the thing that they're so excited to do, and they can be in the joy of what their job is about because they've connected their job to their creative force. And so over the last, 8 years or so, we've created tools for teachers to help them, you know, kind of understand design process. But now we've built this network of teachers called the Teachers Guild. And we are running design challenges with teachers, and we bring in other partners all across the sector so people can listen to teacher-generated ideas and support teachers in actually taking some of their ideas into their classrooms.
That's so cool. So if you're a teacher internationally to New York and the US, is there a way that you can tap into that network?
The teachersguild.org is actually something anybody can join. We actually had a partnership with the RSA in
I love the RSA.
In the UK.
Great podcast.
Yes.
Are you going to go and speak at the, because they have events and live recordings?
I hope to someday.
Yeah.
I'm a big fan.
Yeah, I really enjoy it. They do quite a few podcasts around, next step of what education will look like.
Yeah.
I really enjoy those.
I think they really lead great conversations. And we joined forces with them for a little bit with the teachers in our community and the teachers in their community to imagine how we might redesign the parent-teacher conference. It's called something different in every place, parent-teacher night.
Yeah, we have PTA, Parent-Teacher Association.
Yeah. And so how do you maybe think more closely about how you're designing that interaction between parents and teachers so there's even better communication and teamwork?
I think that's so interesting because, and I'm sure it's moved on a lot, but I think people's common perception of PTA is, you know, let's get together, let's make cakes, let's sell them, let's, you know, create a couple of hundred quid to put in a kitty. But if you think about the actual sort of intellectual collective intelligence of a parental network and what they can bring to a school, you know, whether they're governors or outside of governors, yeah, it's incredible. Like, yeah, and there's a lot more. And I think the conversation at home now is starting to realize that bringing parents into a discussion about what education innovation they want in their school is pretty critical, because they're also huge stakeholders in success of their child's education.
Absolutely. And that's where, again, why education is so complicated to design for, is you've got the state's agenda, the dreams they have for their community, which is the country, but you've got a kid's agenda for where they want to head. You've got all the players across the system who have a point of view about how to do this successfully. You've got teachers who really want to be great at what they do. And you've got parents who are entrusting schools to be part of raising their children.
Yeah.
Everybody is part of designing our school systems.
It's a very impactful statement. So on that note, I think we should probably wrap up, because I think it's a great positive place to leave this conversation. If people are listening in, they would like to connect with you. Are you on Twitter, or is there a good place?
Twitter, yes.
Do you remember your handle?
I do. It is Sandy Spiker, one word, which I wish I had just chosen Sandy S early on.
Yeah.
But S-A-N-D-Y S-P-E-I-C-H-E-R.
And then IDEO is just at IDEO, I'm guessing.
Correct, yeah.
Yeah. Thanks very much.
All right, thank you.
Well, that brings us to the end of our 10-part ASU GSV Summit series. Don't forget to sign up to our newsletter to find out about our upcoming meetup drinks, cool jobs currently circulating, and other announcements. For full references, show notes, and book recommendations, go to theedtechpodcast.com. And for competitions and more, go to our Facebook page, www.facebook.com/podcastedtech. If you're listening in from the UK and you're keen for more design thinking, here's a quick word from Nick Robinson, co-founder and CEO at ELT Jam, on what learner experience design means to him and why ELT Jam are launching Innovate EdTech on November the 11th.
So we build digital learning products and we build them using a lot of sort of ideas from the world of design thinking, but we're not really from a design background as an organisation. We're actually all from a kind of education and curriculum design materials development background. And what we've found as an organization over the past few years is that we've become much more design focused in how we approach learning products and learning design in general. And the reason for this actually came from being asked a few years ago to deliver a sort of very basic training course on user experience and user-centered design. And I kind of had to prep this thing from scratch without actually coming from a design background. And in doing so, I kind of realized that some of the hallmarks of bad user experience, so things like frustration and confusion and anger and that kind of stuff that you see in people that are having a bad user experience, definitely kind of described how many people, I think, felt in classrooms, especially in language teaching classrooms, which is the world we came from. So I kind of had this theory that developed over a few months of whether the user experience of language learning was broken, essentially. And if it was, what might fix it? And from that came this whole idea of, well, if you can design user experience, can you design what we started calling learner experience? So what we started doing was looking at how user experience is designed and how design works more generally and thinking, well, actually, yeah, we could definitely apply that element to, you know, curriculum design, or we could apply that element to the development of a vocabulary app. We could define, add various bits and pieces here and there. And this led to a fairly kind of coherent, I think, methodology around learning product design that we call learner experience design as a thing. And we've been sort of trying to get that idea out there for the past couple of years, originally just in the kind of English language teaching space, but more recently in a kind of wider space. And that's one of the reasons why we're doing the Innovate EdTech Conference on the 10th of November in London with the topic of the rise of learner experience, to look at this topic from a sort of wider education perspective, for us at least initially. And the idea really is to look at what happens when you place the learner at the center of all the decisions you make around the development of a product or around the design of learning. For us, that's really the sort of the core tenet of learner experience design, in the same way that it is with user-centered design in general, that you start with the human being at the center and you sort of work out from that. So we're going to look at this in more depth at the conference in November.
Thanks, Nick. See you back here next week, same time, for more from the EdTech Podcast. Have a great week.